Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So apparently John Kelly's leaving again. Tons of stories today. You know, the adults in the room are leaving. I go, can we get rid of the nonsense that John Kelly is somehow the adult in the room? I mean, he's a co-conspiracy. He's one of them. Stop it already. And I'll tell you, I don't care. Leave. Just go already. Don't keep threatening. Evidently having problems with Melania. That's the latest. A military general can't. Never mind. Good. All I can say is good. Bye. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and New York City. I've got Luke Vargas, chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News at the UN in New York. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
You're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
So what do you think? Kelly going to leave finally. Finally, he's had enough. Can't take Melania or the family.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see what Trump is like with zero adults in the room. With Kelly is gone.
Could it be any worse? Could it be any worse than tweeting out what I've heard every jingoistic idiot say about France? Well, if it wasn't for us, you'd be speaking German.
Yep, that's about as low as it gets for a ceremony that's supposed to reinforce transatlantic relationships. You really cannot. Insult your host more than that. It's so base from Trump. I guess the only possible upside to, having a little bit of a gentler hand managing President Trump is I do think part of his anger is fueled by people telling him what he can't do. This is like I'm looking for a very thin super lining here, which is that given that Kelly, in my view, is not demonstrably improved Trump's erratic tendencies, perhaps he's actually having the effect of provoking them, and that having a little bit more of a less conscious overseer of President Trump in the room actually causes him to back off. He doesn't sense that he's getting pressure from within as opposed to from without, but that's I'm not sure I even agree with this hypothetical I'm trying to create here.
I always love that you try and find the positive, the sunny side of the street. I give you credit for that.
Well, things are so bad right now. We've got to. I mean, laying out just the depressing facts seems like it can't be good for any of us. So we have to hope for some improvement, right?
One would hope. I look at this, and it's one of those moments where you just kind of you go, what exactly is he doing? I'm thinking about what you said there, and I'm going, maybe you're right. Maybe the problem is Kelly's telling him things, and maybe if we just didn't tell him anything, he wouldn't know any better, and he wouldn't say anything.
Right. The question is, to whatever extent Kelly has actually played a role in helping others within the administration shield the president already from the many bad decisions he could have made, but mercifully hasn't yet, and that's where I start to see his departure as being quite concerning. I mean, it seems difficult for me to imagine that people have been removing certain possible executive orders or reminders about horrible policies from the president's desk without Mr. Kelly either being a part of that or knowing about it. And so if you get a system where you basically just have Stephen Miller handing Trump things to sign day in and day out and don't have a little bit more of a conscientious overseer of this whole thing, then maybe we are going to get maybe the president's be a little less angry in terms of rhetoric, but he will be much more effective in terms of executing his policy vision or the policy vision of some of his advisors who really seem to be the masterminds behind a lot of this. So, I do think Kelly, it was an impossible task to ask him to truly rein in the president. But perhaps he has been instrumental in keeping bad agenda items from ever getting ticked off. So his departure could be a step back in that regard.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. Like you said, I don't know how much worse it could get, and maybe it will get a lot worse. Who knows? You remember not too long ago they were talking about Nobel Peace Prizes for Trump and around all of his wonderful work in North Korea. Well, as I'm sure you know, the New York Times reporting today that North Korea is hiding some 16 ballistic missile sites, which Trump says today they already knew about.
Well, of course, the U.S. did know about them. What I think is, and the U.S. intelligence community has been pretty candid in saying, look, we're not refuting any bit of this report, which if Trump really knew about this, then there are two options here. The benefit of the doubt narrative for Trump is that he was simply fooled, right? That he thought Kim Jong-un was doing a lot more than he was publicly stating, in which case we should be concerned about Trump's how gullible he is. And the alternative, which seems to be gathering more and more credence as we learn more, is that the president was trying to dupe the American people into making it seem as if he got an amazing deal out of basically nothing. And that I'm inclined to think is more of the reality here. I mean, you cannot – it's one thing if President Trump described the threat posed by North Korea merely in terms of North Korea's intent to use what they already had and to say, look – the way I have approached the North Korea crisis and the way I have diffused it is not by getting them to reduce the threat that they could pose just from their capabilities, but I have used my relationship with Kim Jong-un to make it seem almost impossible they would intend to carry out an attack. And I think in that respect, maybe Trump has made some improvements, but I never really thought North Korea intended to use its weapons in the first place either. So I think where he becomes can be actively misleading, and we need to see to what extent he changes course here, but is to keep implying when pushed, what actually has been done to limit North Korea's capabilities to attack us. I think the answer pretty clearly at this point is nothing. When pressed on this in the past, the president will cite the destruction of purported destruction of one of their nuclear testing sites and the ongoing demolition of one of their missile launch facilities. But I think now that we see that was just the tip of an iceberg, and below the surface, it's 16 more facilities that are all active. They're not just there, they're getting actively upgraded. Well, then he's, I think, very much distorting the true picture of North Korea's still improving nuclear and missile capabilities and showing us a complete red herring. I mean, you cannot look at those two facilities and say, well, those are being, symbolically demolished. That means things are better. When in fact, during this period of intense scrutiny, North Korea has made the pretty gutsy decision to push ahead with upgrades to its overall capacity. So again, there's more to a threat than just the capabilities. Intent is a real thing to measure. And I do think Trump has lowered whatever little bit of intent North Korea may have had to want to use their weapons. But I don't think there's any way he could possibly claim victory on reducing their capabilities. And without that, this deal with the North Koreans doesn't look like much. And for America's sake, he's basically plugging a hole with his thumb here, right? I mean, as soon as Trump is gone and you have this beautiful romance or whatever he calls his relationship with Kim, and that's gone, then we should be very worried about where America is left with North Korea, because their capabilities will be even stronger. And the only thing seemingly stopping them from being more reckless will be out of the equation, which is Trump.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we talked about this right from the start, though. I mean, I said from the beginning, I fear their con man is better than our con man. And it's playing out. And I believe, as you've put it, I think he just wanted to make it look like he got something, and whether he believes he was misled or he believes something different, I'm not going to say he got duped. I'm just saying he was willfully willing to allow himself to get and us to be screwed over, and this is kind of what it's looking like, and I'm not surprised by it.
Yeah, I mean, what's really remarkable is how much Trump placing this misguided trust in Kim could really hurt our ally in South Korea, because they have put a lot on the line, assuming that this process that Trump was engaged in with the North Koreans was actually going to somehow lead to a sort of pacification of the North Korean regime. And I think many could have said that the goals of the Moon administration in South Korea were somewhat naive from the start, but to probably pair their sort of hope for a brighter future with Trump just putting blind trust in them, and now to probably watch a lot of regression on this narrative about North Korea having moved towards peace, it's going to really hurt President Moon in South Korea when the North Koreans are revealed to have been being very secretively dishonest and actually increasing the threat posed to their neighbors in the South while they symbolically send, you know, anti-landmine crews along the DMZ and do all these other sort of superficial gestures towards peace. It's going to make the sort of peace cohort in South Korea look pretty dumb for having gone with President Trump on this whole thing. And so it's not just the U.S. that loses here. I think Trump's handling of this process and claiming progress that didn't really exist is a liability for many beyond Washington.
Yeah, and shame on us for shame on anyone for buying it. I guess that's where I'm going to leave that. Let's move on. Evidently, the Democrats have a way forward. What's it looking like?
Well, we're getting little bits and pieces about what their strategy is going to be. I've done a number of sort of informal interviews with folks about this, just trying to gauge a little bit about the messaging that the House Democratic majority is going to send out. And I think a lot of it comes down to sort of what kind of leader are we going to have? Is it going to be someone who is trying to hold the caucus to a very rigorous set of talking points and policies so as to have a coherent opposition strategy to President Trump? Or are you going to see someone brought into, so I think Pelosi fits that. I think Pelosi would probably be quite an overseer of the Democratic brand. And much as I think we could use some new blood in Washington, there may be some value to that approach. The alternative is get someone who really speaks for a frustrated base that feels that, the American governance experiment or the way it's being handled right now is just designed to prevent any ideas from ever floating to the top, and that, you know, Democrats need to take stands on as many issues as possible, right? They need to introduce a climate bill that will be voted down so they can make a statement about the environment. They need to, introduce legislation on all fronts and force Trump to veto them or force the Senate to vote them down or not even bring votes. And I happen to think we're going to go towards the Pelosi vision, where it appears that labor is one area where the Democrats are going to introduce some failed or likely to fail legislation so as to put Republicans on their back feet. One is going to be a minimum wage bill, which would propose a doubling of the federal minimum wage from, I think, $7.25 to $15, and also expand overtime pay. But the most of this agenda looks like it's going to be within the committees, right? Investigating to learn more about Trump's taxes, investigating to learn a little bit more about whether there is sort of what the Russian blackmail on President Trump may be, if it concerns any sort of possible money laundering. And finally, sort of going after things like the hurricane response in Puerto Rico or making statements in favor of pre-existing conditions being kept in for healthcare. So the legislative agenda looks to be a little bit thinner, but there is going to be sort of a messaging agenda that concerns itself with oversight. I think it's the Pelosi approach that appears to be winning out in the near term. Don't just have symbolic bills on everything. Pick a good one that people can rally behind. Yep. And tell them the rest will come when you elect Democrats to the Senate.
No, you got to figure out how to, as I've been saying for the longest time, you've got to be pushing an agenda that's going to make people's lives better. And they have to believe that you have the plan to do that. All of the other stuff, all of the climate change stuff, while I agree with, you get lost in the weeds. A lot of the cultural stuff, stick to how you're going to make people's lives better. And I would argue starting with, fixing our voting system. Right now, that should be the first set of investigations, all of the insane stuff. But here's the thing. I mean, I guess it was today you had this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joining a sit-in in Pelosi's office. And I'm going, you do realize you're on her side, right?
Yep. No,
Convene the circular firing squad.
Right. It's tough because I think in many ways, and I'm painting with a huge brush here, but I might as well sink my teeth into it. I mean, that you have people who feel like they Bernie Sanders supporters, people on the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party who feel like they really lost in the DNC chair position, and that the Hillary Clinton approach is still very much overseeing the Democratic machine, and that the sort of, to make up for that, a very vocal, confrontational progressive needs to be installed as House Speaker. I, in many ways, feel like there is still a very open wound about this sort of moderate Democrat versus progressive Democrat fight. And I do think it's regrettable Democrats have not figured out a way to install some of that fighting spirit into their leadership. But I feel like if you took a 30,000-foot view, the better way to do that may have been on the DNC, at the DNC leadership. I'm not sure you want that person to necessarily be the House Speaker during a time when this party is going to get pulled in a lot of different directions as candidates start announcing themselves for president next year. But I can completely understand the sentiment that, hey, this isn't, again, you know, like, look at the people who came into office in the midterms. I don't think Nancy Pelosi is the middle point between the incoming class of Democrats in the House. And so it does feel very foreign to reach back to such, to her type of leadership now. But again, I think you're hitting at something, which is that there will be a lot of there's a higher potential for Democratic infighting if the speakership goes to someone who really wants to, hold the older Democrats to account. And that might be a vulnerability and something that Trump could play off.
Yeah, we're going to see how this plays out. I want to get your thoughts on Jim Acosta. Trump, basically threw them out for really trumped up reasons. I mean, that whole assault thing was kind of complete nonsense. And the whole rude thing, look, the guy's doing his job. I guess CNN is now suing the White House over revoking his press credentials. Is there any basis for the suit, and where do you see this going?
They think there is. They're filing this in the D.C. District Court. They basically are arguing that the Constitution embraces a definition of the First Amendment that basically says, look, public, and this is, they're quoting a Supreme Court ruling here that interpreted the First Amendment to say that it allows for debate on public issues to be uninhibited and may well include sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks against government and against public officials, but that's built into the equation. And that the president lacks the authority to basically crush that debate on those First Amendment freedoms. Now, the D.C. Circuit Court has in the past said that journalists must get access from the government or must be entitled to that access, and it may only be invoked for, quote, compelling reasons, end quote. And they basically say, the District Court of D.C. has said in the past that reasonable claims of revoking a pass have to be based on demonstrated facts, and they need to allow for the injured persons here, the people losing their access, to be able to rebut those points and make a case for their own, innocence. And the White House, I think it can be said quite clearly, in doctoring a video showing the evidence of Mr. Acosta, according to the White House, hitting an intern is not going to hold up as a demonstrated fact in a court. And the changing narrative from the White House about why this, pass has been revoked, first that it was an act of violence, and now Sarah Sanders saying today that the reason for taking the pass away was because Acosta did not yield to another reporter when asked to go on to another question. That also, I think, quite undermines the White House argument here that they had a pretty coherent fact-based rationale for doing this. That said, I have all bets are off. I don't know. It's really hard to handicap the judges on specific courts, and it's I don't have any guess of where this is going to go. But CNN's argument here, which does seem to hinge on the White House showing some tangible facts about the reason Acosta had to lose this pass, that's a pretty weak defense for them to rest on, given how I think really intellectually dishonest they've been about the reasons for revoking his pass in the first place.
Yeah, well, he did stab her, right? I mean, multiple times, right?
I love what Kellyanne Conway is saying. Look, we didn't doctorate. We just sped it up. And she's like, well, that's what they do all the time in sports. It's like, A, that's not relevant at all. And two, in sports, they actually don't slow things up. They don't speed things up. They slow them down. Yeah. So you can actually see what happens. This, I mean, they are just completely contorted trying to excuse their dishonesty about this. And it's kind of hilarious to watch. But I really, it would be terrific, wouldn't it, if there were actually some legal recourse when the White House does one of these, it's just so brazenly wrong things to do. I'm just not so certain we can count on the courts to do that. I feel like CNN has sort of won the court of public opinion on this. But do they actually get their reporter back in? And does the White House get held to account for their lack of ethics here? I'm not sure that's going to necessarily happen.
Yeah. And finally, HQ2, we have liftoff.
Yeah, right. Because why, for any reason, would a massive company that wants to attract top talent ever move to a beautiful city like New York unless they had nearly $3 billion in tax incentives? I mean, New York, basically, there are no employers in New York, right, unless they get huge tax rebates. It's just so, I think it is so frustrating that Amazon said, look, we're going to put 50,000 employees somewhere, you know, beg for it. And there was, I don't think, really any sign this was ever really a competition for places other than New York and D.C., which are within these two locations, someone tweeted out, are within 30 minutes of Jeff Bezos' homes. It was all about which city do Amazon executives want to live in? And D.C. and New York are the clear favorites. I mean, this notion that Louisville and Nashville or all these other places were in consideration makes me sad that other people's time was wasted and these cities just sort of laid themselves at the altar of Amazon here. And they pulled a move that one marketing leader from NYU tweeted about that I found hilarious. They pulled the move that you sometimes see it like this, in an auction, right? Like someone is going to be offering, you know, you can have a dinner with the chancellor of the university and someone bids $8,000 and then someone bids $9,000 and they say, well, you know what? We've just talked to the chancellor and he's willing to do two dinners. So we're going to take that $9,000 winning bid and we're going to take the $8,000 bid and you both win and he'll do two dinners. That's what they did here. They got New York and D.C. to pay full price in what they were willing to give up to get these 50,000 jobs. And they took both packages and then turned around and watered down the quality of the experience that they were giving. Right. The prize here has been watered down to 25,000 jobs each for the cities as opposed to 50. And the cities are not cutting in half their incentives packages. In fact, I was just reading through the New York one. Amazon, in exchange for paying a tax on $1.3 billion in city taxes and $1.5 billion in state taxes, is going to make space available at their new headquarters in Long Island City for a tech startup incubator. And they are going to donate space for the construction, but not actually going to pay to construct another elementary school in the neighborhood. Both things of which, to me, are further benefits to Google or to Amazon, not to the city. I mean, yes, a school is great, but it's going to be in a neighborhood where all of the Amazon people live. So it seems like a benefit for them. And the a tech incubator within a tech company is not necessarily a public good. I mean, yes, it will create more jobs, but that's the kind of thing where Amazon is going to be acquiring those tech startups, not donating the startups to New York City. So again, it just and it's, I think, made all the worse by folks like Andrew Cuomo, who make jokes saying, I'm going to name myself Amazon Cuomo if we land this, and are just so proud of this headline. I'm not surprised to hear there are protests planned in New York for tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised if the same holds true for D.C., but the fact that cities just seem to be doing anything they can, especially cities with such density problems and problems with public services already, basically subsidizing the salaries of these workers, to me, just seems like very misplaced priorities. But there you have it.
It's what we've been doing for almost a generation now, so not surprising. But, Luke, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.